I guess I want to begin by first of all thanking my publicist, Uncle Avi. I appreciate that. Rishos, my father. I want to thank again Uncle Avi for giving me the opportunity, the privilege, what I see as an awesome privilege to be able to give a Yahrzeit shiur for Zaidi. I apologize for those who don't refer to him as Zaidi, but I guess I speak on behalf of all the grandchildren, so I'm going to be saying Zaidi as opposed to anything else. But I do want to thank, I assume, Uncle Avi as the messenger for all the other siblings, but so thank you to everyone for allowing me, I guess, to give a little bit of Divrei Torah, Le'iloi Nishmaso. I think every grandchild probably feels that they have a unique connection to a grandfather, and there's probably a lot of truth to that. And I think specifically with me, I remember about 2 years ago, or 2 years into my YU experience, I should say, I remember going over to my mother and expressing how much I felt like I missed Zaidi. And that was largely because, you know, the circumstance and the atmosphere that I was in, always felt like I very much wanted Zaidi to be there to be able to talk to him about, you know, I was learning from the Rav Salavitchik students, I was learning that tradition, I was part of that tradition. And I always felt it would have been, you know, really, really nice if I had Zaidi to talk to, if I just had him to talk to see what his experience was like, what his experience with the Rav was like. And I always felt like, I don't know, I always felt like in terms of all the grandchildren, I always felt like I was kind of the one that kind of had that role of being able to continue that tradition of Zaidi. And because of that, there was always, unfortunately, he was never there when I was in YU. And I always had that kind of sense of sadness, perhaps loneliness, on one hand. And on the other hand, some sense of pride. Pride that, you know, I felt like I was kind of, you know, keeping the torch lit and being able to continue that tradition, which Zaidi was really a part of. And those, you know, mixed emotions, to give the sheer title away, those mixed emotions I kind of always felt. And the reason why I wanted to give the shiur on this topic, again, the topic of mixed emotions, and I'll continue a little more as to what exactly I'm referring to. The reason was really, or the impetus was really two different things. Firstly, I always felt it was a little bit ironic. I don't know if that's the right word, but there's a certain sense of irony that Zaidi's Yahrzeit is Chaf Tes Shvat, the 29th day of Shvat. And the reason why it's ironic is because, I mean, the children unfortunately know better than anyone else. But that what that really means is that as you're sitting Shiva, the halacha tells you that Mishanichnas Adar Marbin Besimcha. And there's a certain irony in that, that you have a sense of terrible loss, and yet also the halacha tells you you're supposed to increase your joy, increase your simcha. And it's very hard for those to coexist, those mixed emotions to coexist. And because of that irony, I always felt it was an interesting thing to talk about. That was reason number one why I wanted to decide on the shiur. Reason number two why I wanted to decide on the shiur is because on Tuesday, March 14th, 1978, the Rav was planning on giving a shiur in the Moriah Shul. He would give there a shiur every week to Baal HaBatim, just to lay people, not to anyone in the yeshiva. And he gave it every week. And on March 14th, 1978, he was supposed to give the shiur. At about 7:45, one of the Rav's assistants called and said that the Rav wasn't feeling well, and that he's going to continue next week, and it's probably going to be a shiur on topics in Purim. So the next week, which was March 21st, 1978, that Tuesday, which happened also to be the night before Tanis Esther, or Yud Gimel Adar, the Rav gave a shiur on topics of Purim, and it's a very long shiur. The shiur is about 2 hours and 10 minutes. It started at about 8:05, ended at 10:15. And in that, he discussed many, many topics within Purim. And one of the topics he discussed is a topic that I wanted to explore tonight. Now, the reason why I know all that information, in case anyone was curious, is because Zaidi wrote every single one of those things down in his notebooks. Every single one. Shiur canceled last minute. I'm reading it off. Shiur canceled last minute. One of Rav's assistants called Shul about 7:45 to tell that the Rav was not feeling well, but hoped to give Shiur next week, etc., etc. So that all that information is part of probably what you would diagnose as OCD or OCPD, depending on how psychological aware you are. But yeah, so I know all that information from that. But anyways, in that shiur, the Rav discussed the topic that I wanted to discuss. And that's the topic of Avelos, mourning, on Purim. Is there mourning on Purim? Is one allowed to mourn on Purim? And it's a discussion that's discussed by many. But really, the discussion starts from the following. You know, we have a Masechta in Shas. There's a Gemara that discusses the laws of mourning, the laws of Avelos. It's Maseches Moed Katan. The last parak of Moed Katan is called Parak Elu Megalchen. That's where all the halachos, almost all, I should say, all the halachos of Avelos, of mourning, comes up. If you look through that entire parak, nowhere do you find Purim. Nowhere do you find the talk of Purim. Now, because of that, that would lead one to believe, and it's probably a correct assumption, that if the Gemara never discussed Purim, then the day of Purim is most likely like every other day of the year. Namely, just like any other Sunday, Monday, Tuesday, or Wednesday, we say that there are laws of mourning that apply when unfortunately someone needs to. So too on Purim. And this is the opinion in the 12th century of the Rambam. The Rambam writes in his halachos that when there is the day of Purim and someone unfortunately has to sit Shiva, you sit Shiva on Purim, just like any other day. That's the opinion of the Rambam, that's one extreme. The total other extreme is the opinion of the Rush. The Rush came a little while after the Rambam, in the end of the 13th century. So the Rush, in his halachos, says that no, Purim is like every other Yom Tov. Just like every Yom Tov we know, if someone unfortunately has to hit Shiva, and they about to be a Yontif, so they're sitting Shiva on Erev Pesach, and then it's Pesach, so Pesach totally uproots that Shiva. Namely, there is no more Shiva. Shiva goes, and then it like hits a wall and falls off. No more Shiva. That's what the Mishnah Moed Katan tells us. So the Rosh says the same with Purim. That Purim will totally discount and uproot the whole idea, the whole halacha of sitting Shiva. Those are the two extremes. Now the Shulchan Aruch paskins like the Rambam. So the Shulchan Aruch says if someone has to sit Shiva on Purim, they sit Shiva on Purim. Like any other day of the year. Purim's not anything unique. The Ramah, which is how the Ashkenazim paskin, and I think everyone here is probably Ashkenazi, at least everyone that I know here, but I assume everyone is Ashkenazi. So I can't see everyone at the time, but the Ramah paskins not like the Rambam and not like the Rush, not like the two extremes. He has a middle of the opinion approach, and his approach is given by the Maharami Rotenberg. The Maharami Rotenberg lived a little before the Rush. The Maharami Rotenberg was actually a Rebbe of the Rush. And the Maharami Rotenberg tells us that Purim, you don't do Avelos completely, and it doesn't totally knock out Avelos. Rather, we treat Purim like Shabbos. What does that mean? So if you look in the Mishnah tells us that there's a difference, there's a distinction between a Yom Tov and a Shabbos in regards to sitting Shiva. Namely, if one was sitting Shiva and Yom Tov came, so we know there is no more Shiva. Shiva totally is uprooted, there's nothing left. But by Shabbos, there's something unique. By Shabbos, what we say is that you do some forms of mourning. You do what we call Avelos Bitzina. You have mourning, private mourning, not public mourning. And nevertheless, Shabbos counts towards Shiva. So just to give an example, if someone's sitting their third day of Shiva on Friday, so Shabbos is considered the fourth day of Shiva, even though you're not allowed to physically sit Shiva like we would on the ground. You do private mourning, not public mourning. And then Sunday becomes the fifth day of Shiva. And it just continues. Unlike Yontif, which Yontif just totally, it blocks Shiva. It can't continue anymore. So the Maharami Rotenberg, and this is the opinion of the Ramah, writes that if someone has to sit Shiva, and Purim comes, so you treat it like Shabbos. So you don't do anything public, you don't do any mourning publicly. Rather, you do private mourning. And the next day, the day after Purim, Shushan Purim, you would continue sitting that Shiva. That's the opinion of the Ramah. And the question that the Rav asked in this shir that Zaidi wrote, again, any information I have is really from what Zaidi wrote in his notebook. I never saw this written up anywhere else. But the question that the Rav asked is why would you assume that Purim is different than any other Yom Tov? By all other Yomim Tovim, by all other holidays, we know the Pasuk tells us we have to rejoice. V'samachta b'chagecha. Right, we have to rejoice. There's what we call Simchas Yom Tov. There's an obligation to be joyous. On Purim, Mordechai instituted Yom Mishteh V'Simcha, a day of happiness, a day of joy. So if the joy on a Yom Tov, on a regular Yom Tov, totally doesn't allow, seizes the entire day from existence, the entire Shiva from existence, so too, Purim should do the same exact thing. And that's really the general question, the important question that one needs to ask, why Purim would be any different. And the Rav explained it based off the following. In general, in Halacha, and really in Hashkafa as well, in our Jewish perspective, there are two different types, perhaps three, but two different types of what we call Kedushos. Two different types of sanctifications. So for example, one of those types, the Mishnah in Kalim tells us that there are Eser Kedushos, there are 10 types of Kedusha. That's referring to what we call Kedushas HaMakom, geographical Kedusha. So the Mishnah tells us, Eretz Yisrael, the land of Israel, is the holiest place. Now, within Eretz Yisrael, there are levels, until you get to the Kodesh Kadashim. There are different levels of Kedusha, of holiness, within the land. All that is subsumed into this idea of Kedushas HaMakom, sanctity of place of geographical location. That's one type of Kedusha. And there are many different halachic ramifications, many different nafkaminos, about the place, the geographical location being holy. Then there's another type of Kedusha, that which we call Kedushas Hazman, sanctification of time. So, for example, Yom Tov. Every single year, the 15th of Nisan hits, it's Pesach, and it is imbued with a sense of Kedusha. It is imbued with sanctity, different than any other day of the year. That's not a Yom Tov. But it's imbued with that sanctity. Kedusha Sazman. There are time periods that there is Kedusha. So the Rav explained the following. You see, Purim and every other Yom Tov both have Simcha. They both have an obligation to rejoice. They both have an obligation to be happy. But there's one major difference between the two. On a regular Yom Tov, there's also additionally what's called Kedushas Hazman. The day is imbued with sanctity, with holiness. And because of that, the Rav explained, that day being elevated to a day that's holier than any other day of the year engenders causes, is the source of our obligation to be happy, to be besimcha on that day. So, on the 15th of Nisan, because the day is holier than every other day of the year, that's really the source of our obligation to be happier than any other day of the year. Because it's a more elevated day, so our joy has to be elevated as well, because when we realize that the day is elevated, we realize how in front of God, or closer to God, we truly are. And that is really the whole idea behind the Simcha of Yom Tov. As the Rambam explains and many other, it's a Simcha, it's a joy of Lifnei Hashem. A joy of being before God. And so when the day is elevated, when there is Kedushas Hazman, and the sanctity to that day, so that engenders, that causes, that obligates us to then be happy. And that's the source. On Purim, however, Purim has no, what we call Kedushas Hazman. Purim has no inherent sanctity. The day of Purim is like every other day of the year. It's like any other Tuesday. The difference is we have obligations. We have to do certain things, and we have an obligation of being happy. We have an obligation to read the Megillah, give Mishloach Manos, Matanos Lavionim, etc. A Seuda, that's really the only other, etc. But we have an obligation to do all these things. But the day itself isn't imbued with sanctity, there isn't inherent Kedusha. And therefore, the source of the Simcha is not inherent Kedusha. So why does that make a difference? So the Rav explained, again I'm reading this into these notes, to the notes of Zaidi, but this is how the Rav seemed to explain it. If the source of my simcha, which is in contradistinction to avelos, right? Mourning and happiness can't coexist. If the source of my simcha is that the day is elevated, then the day is so elevated that avelos, that mourning, can't ever enter into it. It's blocked. There's nothing to go into it. As opposed to if the simcha, which is again in contradiction to the mourning, but that's not because the day is elevated. There's just a separate obligation that I'm supposed to be happy. So anytime it contradicts, then we're going to have a problem. And we're going to say the Simcha wins out. But when it doesn't contradict, there's no problem. Therefore, anytime the Avelos, the mourning, is public, it's going to contradict my obligation to be happy. But when it's private, that's not going to contradict anything. Because again, the day isn't elevated. The day doesn't block the mourning. It's not that there's kedushas azman, the day isn't sanctified in that sense. And therefore, it can still go into the day, it has to go into a way that doesn't contradict the happiness, the simcha. And therefore, that's what the Rav explains. So when we have avelos by every other yontif, the avelos contradicts the whole day, because the whole day is imbued with kedusha, and that's the source of our joy, that's the joy source of our simcha, and therefore there's nothing to do. So once yontif hits, there's no more shiva, it's done. But when it comes to Purim, it's much different. By Purim, the day doesn't contradict the avelos, only my simcha does. So anything that's public is going to contradict, and the simcha is going to win. But when it's private, I can still do private actions of mourning, and therefore Purim can still count towards my shiva. A very, what we would call a lumdish way of understanding this whole topic. But it gives us an important sense, a distinction between the obligation of joy on Purim and the obligation of joy in every other regel, every other Yom Tov. What it doesn't explain, and that's what we're going to have to figure out, is what exactly is the joy on Purim? What exactly is this obligation to be joyous on Purim? If it's not like all the other regalim, namely, it's not that it's how you define the simcha is not by the sanctity of the day itself, there's a different definition. So what exactly is that definition? So there's a Talmud Yerushalmi. Figured most people here are living in the Holy Land, so I figured I can discuss the Talmud Yerushalmi as opposed to the Bavli. But the Talmud Yerushalmi writes in Meseches Megillah, at the very beginning, that the source of Simcha seems to be from a drasha, from a pasuk. The Gemara tries figuring out what happens when Shabbos falls out on Purim, or Purim falls out on Shabbos. So when do I have my Seuda? Right, we already know, the Halacha tells us about Mishloach Manos, about Megillah, about Matanos Lavyonim. There are reasons why you can't do that on Purim. But why can't I have my Seuda? I have an obligation to have a meal on Purim. Why can't I do that on Shabbos? So after Shacharis, after Musaf on Shabbos, I go home, and I'm having a meal anyway, and I want to say, this meal is also for Purim. I want to be Mekayim, I want to fulfill my Seudas Purim on Shabbos. So the Yerushalmi says, I can't do that. You're not allowed to do that. Why not? What's the problem? So the Yerushalmi brings a drasha. The rabbis tell us the reason is because the pasuk in Megillas Esther says that when Esther and Mordechai instituted that there was going to be a day in the future called Purim, the next year, or 2 days called Purim, they instituted that those days, la'asos osam yimei mishteh v'simcha, that we should make those days into days of mishteh v'simcha, days of happiness and festivity and drinking and suda. And so the Yerushalmi says the following drasha: Escha simchaso tluya bidei shamayim, that which is simcha, that which is joy, is dependent. Sorry, bebezdin on bezdin. Yatza ze shesimchaso tluya bidei shamayim, and this excludes joy which is dependent on the heavens, namely, on Purim. The pasuk says laasos osam yemei mishteh v'simcha, to make the days into days of mishteh v'simcha. Namely, it's about creating the day, creating the joy. I have to create the simcha. That's what Purim is. Shabbos is not like that. Shabbos is what we call kviya v'kaima. It's set in stone. Every 7 days since God created the world, no matter what, is Shabbos. Whether we like it or not, whether we accept it upon ourselves or not, it is Shabbos every 7 days. And so therefore the Yerushalmi tells us, if I were to go on Purim, on Shabbos, to go to my Shabbos meal, and say, I want this also to be Purim, it doesn't make sense. Because by Purim, I have to create the Mishnah V'simcha, la'asos. I have to make it. But on Shabbos, it's already been made. The day is imbued with that Kedusha. I'm not doing anything. It's Bidei Shemayim, the heavens instituted. Today is Shabbos. I don't need to do anything. So I can't then say, oh, I'm making my Purim Suda, because I'm not making anything. Because the day is already there, the Kedusha is already there, the Simcha is already there. That's what the Yerushalmi tells us. So what comes out of the Yerushalmi is something very, very important. What you see is that the mitzvah of Simcha, of being joyous on Purim, is a mitzvah la'asos. To do it ourselves, we have to create that joy. It's not that there's already joy, there's already something here. We have to make it. La'asos osam yimei mishteh v'simcha. There's actually something even further that comes out of what the Yerushalmi is telling us. It's not just we have to create it, but what we're doing is la'asos osam yimei mishteh v'simcha. What the simcha is, to make it into a day of simcha. This is very, very different than the obligation of simchas yom tov. The other obligation, the other mitzvah, of being happy, of being joyous on yom tov. By a regular yom tov, the obligation is incumbent upon each individual to be happy. On Purim, it's not that. On Purim, what it is I am supposed to create a day, a yom of mishteh v'simcha. Just to bring one quick proof, if you'll indulge me for 1 second, to this idea, from the following. When the Rambam defines these two mitzvos, when the Rambam defines the mitzvah of simcha on Yom Tov, of being joyous on Yom Tov, and simcha on Purim, he defines them very, very differently. When he defines the mitzvah on Purim, so the Rambam writes in his Halachos, in Perek Beis of Hilchos Megillah, mitzvahs yom arba'asar, so the mitzvah on the day of Purim, etc., etc., lihiyos yom simcha u'mishteh, that it should be a day of mishteh and simcha. It should be a day of happiness. That's what the mitzvah is. On a regular Yom Tov, when the Rambam is defining our obligation to be happy, the Rambam writes, in Hilchos Yom Tov in the 6th parak, V'chayav Adam lihiyos bahen sameach v'tov lev. A person is obligated to be happy on these days. A much different definition. On a regular Yom Tov, I'm obligated to be happy. That's the obligation, that's the mitzvah. On Purim, I have to create the day. The day has to be a day that's merry. A day of happiness. There's a tremendous difference between the two. In fact, there's a sefer called the Emek Bracha. It was written by someone who was a student in the Volozhin Yeshiva originally, back in Eastern Europe, and then he became a big Talmud of Rav Velvula Soloveitchik, the Brisker Rav. The Brisker Rav was a son of Reb Chaim Soloveitchik, who was a son of the Beis Halevi. The Brisker Rav was also the uncle of the Rav, who we know as Rav Yosef Dov Soloveitchik. So he quotes from the Brisker Rav a very similar idea, and he writes, you know, on every other Yom Tov, so the obligation is incumbent upon me to be happy. And that's in any way possible. As long as I can reach an outcome where I feel happy, I have fulfilled a mitzvah called Simchas Yom Tov, to be happy on Yom Tov. So for example, the Gemara in Pesachim tells us that I can do all these different things other than just eating meat and drinking wine. Having presents, if someone really likes chocolate. So if you have chocolate on Yom Tov and that gives you joy, so you fulfill the mitzvah of Simchas Yom Tov. As opposed to Purim, says the Brisker Rav. Because on Purim, it's a much different experience. On Purim, Chazal told us a formula for how to reach this simcha. I.e., Chazal told you how to make this day into a yom mishteh v'simcha. How am I osam these days into a yimei mishteh v'simcha? How do I do that? So there are different ways. Chayiv inish lipsume, the Gemara tells us, we're supposed to, I don't know if my mom's on the Zoom, but we're supposed to drink a little bit of wine, a little bit. We're supposed to have a suda, all these different things. But these are the formula to reach this, to create this festive atmosphere. So what happens if a person, I personally am not a fan of wine. I don't like wine. So should I drink wine on Purim? Leaving that whole discussion aside, but me'ikar adin, let's just call it. The answer is yes, because it's not about me subjectively. It's about me creating an atmosphere of mishteh v'simcha. It's about me creating this festive atmosphere. And so on some level, it's irrelevant how I feel. Now, obviously, it's important, and part of the, if not the ikkar, the main avoda, the main work on Purim itself, is to be happy. That's what the day is about. But the happiness is really to create this festive atmosphere, to create an atmosphere, la'asos osam yimei mishteh v'simcha, to create them, to make them into days of happiness and su'udah, and festivity. And that's really the major distinction between Purim and all other Simchas Yom Tov. And if that's true, I think we can explain what we were saying before really, really beautifully. We mentioned that the Rama writes that unlike by every other Yom Tov, where if Shiva hits the Yontif, it's totally excluded. There's no more Shiva. It's uprooted. It's done. But if Shiva hits Purim, it can still kind of enter the day, and you can fulfill mourning privately, just not publicly. And we asked, why would it be different than all other Yom Tovim? Why is it different than any other holiday? And with this, I think we can give a beautiful answer, because there's something unique about Purim. This simcha on Purim is not a subjective simcha. You see, if it was a subjective simcha, it was how I felt, then the obligation is for me to be happy the entire day. So how am I ever supposed to have avelos? How can mourning ever enter into my being, or the person who's mourning, into their being, if they're obligated the entire day to be happy? But Purim, that's not the case, because Purim, it's not about you being happy the entire day. It's about creating a festive atmosphere. It's about making a Yom Mishteh V'Simcha. And if that's true, so public mourning is going to obviously contradict creating a festive atmosphere, but private mourning doesn't necessarily contradict it. I can still privately mourn while the atmosphere being festive, while me not affecting the atmosphere, while it's still being a Yom Mishteh V'Simcha. And perhaps this helps us deepen our understanding of why the Rama holds that Purim can still count for Avelos. It's a much different type of Simcha. It's about creating an atmosphere that's festive. And I think all this being said speaks to the point where Purim specifically, perhaps, underscores this idea, this concept, that one is able to, in Judaism, able to have mixed emotions. Just because, you know, one is unfortunately feeling very sad, doesn't mean there can't also be happiness. Now, obviously, at times they contradict. But someone can come into a day and feel very happy and have moments of sadness. And the mixed emotions are normal. And perhaps they're encouraged. We're not supposed to be people of extremes. We'll discuss in a few minutes, Bli Neder and Mirza Hashem, but we're not supposed to be people that just feel intense happiness or intense sadness. And we're supposed to have some level of mixed emotions. And Purim, more than other holidays, underscores this idea. The idea that we can create a festive atmosphere, but yet Avelos can still come in there. There can still be some level of mourning. And it's not necessarily a contradiction. Head on, they may be a contradiction. But the two concepts aren't naturally, at least, a contradiction. I think if you look through Megillas Esther, and I don't want to spend so much time, so I'm not going to give too many examples, so I guess everyone can do their homework and figure out where else this comes up. But if you look through the Megillah, you kind of see this throughout, this idea of emotions going up and down. You know, most stories, so you're taught in English class, when you learn literature, so the way novels work is you start, and then you go up to the climax, and then you go back down. Right? That's just the next. Sometimes you go up once or twice. But if you read through the Megillah, it's like the whole time the emotions are up, down, up, down. Even though that what under, you know, the base of the whole story is that Haman wants to kill all Jews and then we're saved. But throughout, there are just emotions that are going up and down and up and down. One of the things you notice is that the Rishon, that the evil people in the story, i.e. Haman and Achashverosh, are not able to have mixed emotions coexist. And so just to give perhaps one example, and I think there are many, but just to give one example, in the fifth parak of Megillas Esther, after Esther tells Achashverosh she wants to make a feast for Haman and Achashverosh, because she's going to want to inform Achashverosh that Haman's trying to kill her people. So after the first feast, Esther says, come back for another one. And Haman leaves this feast, and again, if you look in Parak Hey, Pasuk Tes, Vayetze Haman Bayomahu, Haman leaves that day, Sameach V'Tov Lev. That same language that the Rambam uses for our obligation of Simchas Yom Tov. Sameach V'Tov Lev. But he's out, he's extraordinarily happy. Ucharos Haman is Mordechai B'Shar HaMelech, and as soon as he sees Mordechai sitting in the gate, V'lo Kam V'lo Zam Imenu. He doesn't get up, he doesn't move. So he gets angry at Mordechai, and somewhat of a natural reaction for someone who's chasing honor. So the next pasuk says he controls himself. He doesn't do anything at that moment, and he comes home. He gathers his whole family. We see from the next pasuk how much he lacked self-confidence. He needs to gather his whole family to tell them how rich he is and how great he is. Verov banav, how many children he has. V'yisasher gidlo, his power. V'yisasher gidlo ha-melech. V'yisasher nisaw al-asarim v'abdei ha-melech. He was raised above all the other people. V'yomer ha-mon. Af lo hevia Esther ha-malkam ha-melech. Ela meshter asher asasa ki mosi. Esther decided to bring no one else aside for the king and me to the feast. Not only today did I have a feast with just the king and Esther and the queen, but even tomorrow I'm invited back for this private meal. And then he says the following, V'chol ze einenu shoveli. None of this makes a difference to me. None of it matters, because when I see Mordechai, it makes no difference. How is it possible? Haman is on top of the world. The amount of money, the power, the prestige, he was invited to this private party, and the fact that he sees Mordechai, someone who he doesn't like, who doesn't like him, that ruins everything. Nothing makes a difference anymore. Everything is worthless every time I see Mordechai. That makes no sense. It's like going to a meal where you have everything you love, and then there's one food you don't like. Would you say, V'chol zeh einenu shoveli? Right, the rest of the meal is totally irrelevant. I just can't wrap my head around that food that I don't like. That doesn't make any sense. How is it possible that Haman was saying this? How is it possible that Haman was saying, V'chol zeh einenu shoveli, everything I have, all the money, the power, makes no difference to me. Because when I see Mordechai, you know, I just can't get it out of my head. It just angers me so much. And the reason is because Haman, part of his characteristic of being evil, is that he didn't understand how to balance emotions. His emotions were on extremes. Either he was sameach v'tov lev, or he was b'chol zayin enu shoveli. There was no way to balance. There was no way to have mixed emotions coexist. And that's who Haman was at his core. And it's obviously a terrible, terrible thing to be. That's what the Megillah is trying to tell us. That's not what you're supposed to say. You know, I think it's quoted in the name of the Ben Ish Chai, that he asked the question on the Pasuk. You know, the Pasuk says again, V'chol zeh einenu shoveli. None of this makes a difference. V'chol yis asher ani roes Mordechai ha-Yehudi yoshev b'shar ha-Melech. Every time you see Mordechai sitting. And so he asks, why the Megillah adds the word yoshev? Meaning, the Pasuk could have said, V'chol zeh einenu shoveli, none of this makes sense. V'chol yis asher ani roes Mordechai ha-Yehudi b'shar ha-Melech. Because every time I see Mordechai, I can't handle it. What's Yoshev? What does that make a difference, that he's sitting, B'shar HaMelech? And so I think this speaks very well to our idea. Mordechai, Haman understood Mordechai's mentality at this moment in history. He knew that Mordechai was mourning. He knew that Mordechai was crying out to God. He knew he was davening to Hashem. He saw all of that. Mordechai went public with it. He was wearing sackcloth, he was crying, he was fasting. And Haman, he got some enjoyment out of that. But what Haman was saying, what he can't handle, is how it's possible that if that's what Mordechai is feeling, how is he Yoshev? How is he able to just sit there when I walk by? How is he able to sit there so calm? How is he able to do that? And the truth is that's originally, the Pasuk tells us that Mordechai was lo kam, he didn't get up v'loza. He didn't move. It didn't bother him. Nothing bothered him. He was cool, calm, and collected. He was ragua, as we say. He was just relaxed. And even though obviously he was mourning and he was crying out to God, and Haman just couldn't wrap his head around that. Because Mordechai understood that you can have mixed emotions. You don't have to go to an extreme. Just because I'm crying out to God and screaming doesn't mean every time I see Haman, I have to get up and throw tomatoes at him. I can be relaxed at times, and I can be very, very sad at times. Haman didn't understand that. For Haman, it was either sameach v'tov lev, either I'm in full enjoyment, or something bothers me, kol zeh einenu shoveli. Nothing makes a difference. And that's part of what was so evil about Haman. And part of what we need to do as Jews, but really as people of the world, is understand that there's a balance of emotions. And that balance of emotions are important, number one, because a lot of times they can define and help us wrap our head around one. For example, the Pasuk in Tehillim tells us in the second parak, V'gilu b'ra'ada, that we're supposed to rejoice with God trembling. So the Gemara in Brachos tells us, B'makum gila sham tehei ra'ada. At that place, when you're going to rejoice, that's where there should be trembling and fear. And the idea is that we don't want any of them to get extreme. We can't have extreme rejoicing, because that's going to lead to things that aren't good. And we can't have extreme sadness. And so the trembling is supposed to help us control our gila. It's supposed to help us control our feelings of joy and our ecstasy. And that's why it's important to constantly balance our emotions. But I think it's perhaps important for another reason. You know, the Rambam describes at the beginning of Hilchos Deos, where the Rambam discusses, for lack of a different translation, the temperaments of man, the way we're supposed to feel. And again, it's a halacha sefer. But the Rambam discusses the way we're supposed to act, the way we're supposed to react, the emotions we're supposed to feel in life in general. And the Rambam begins that discussion in Perek Aleph, discussing the Mida Beinonis, the Shvil Hazav, the golden mean, the middle path, the way we're supposed to act. We're never supposed to act with extremes. We're always supposed to act calm, collected. And the Rambam gives examples of different things. So many people understand the Rambam incorrectly, that what that means is if you think of any emotion, any Mida, any characteristic, so you can go to one extreme as a 10, and the other extreme is a 1. And so what the Mida Beinonis says is to act as a 5. That's the Shvil Azov, the middle, the golden path. But that's not what the Rambam is telling us. Now most of the time, yeah, you're supposed to act as a 5. But the Rambam basically says is that you're supposed to have both capabilities. Capabilities for both types of Midos, for both types of emotions. And you have to figure out when it's appropriate to go to 7, to go to 3. So just to give one example, the Rambam writes, in Halacha Daled, Lo yichos kas, anger is a terrible, terrible mida. And therefore we're supposed to do the mida beinonis. What does that mean? Lo yichos ella al davar gadol sherai lichos alav. Don't get really upset unless it's something you really need to get upset about. What do you mean? The golden path is 5. I'm never supposed to go more than that. No, but the idea is when it's something you're supposed to get upset, it's supposed to be 7. And the Rambam discusses that in the next halacha, that that's really the higher level when you're able to realize and calibrate where your emotions are really supposed to be. You're able to understand based off circumstance, based off context, how you're supposed to react in a given situation. The Rambam ends off, the Rambam says this is all a kiyum of fulfillment. Acting in this way, with the mida beinonis, this golden mean, is a fulfillment of the mitzvah of the halachta bedrachav. Imitatio Dei, to imitate God. That mitzvah, the oraisa, that obligation, that mandate to copy God's actions and His character traits tells us to act in this way. To act not in extremes and to understand based off context and circumstance when to sway a little bit, when to go back and forth. In fact, the Rambam writes in Halacha Zayim at the end of Perek Aleph that this is what Avraham Avinu taught his children. The Pasuk tells us, Vihi shalom da Avram avinu levanav shenemar. This is what Avram taught his children. This is what the Pasuk, the Torah, tells. Ki dativ l'man asher yitzaveh ez banav ve'ez beso acharav. That this is what he commanded his children, his children's children. Vishamru derech Hashem. To guard the derech Hashem. This is called the derech Hashem. The mida beinonis, to act with this way. La'asos staka u'mishpat. To do staka, righteousness, charity, umishpat, and justice. And one reason the Rambam is bringing this halacha is because the Derech Hashem is what he's referring to. But the other reason, perhaps, is because the end of that pasuk, what Avraham Avinu teaches his children, is to do tzedakah and mishpat. Now the Gemara points out that there's a contradiction there. If he's going to teach them mishpat, if he's going to teach them justice, that's by the letter of the law, then there can't be tzedakah. Tzedakah is going above. And if he's going to teach them about going above the letter of the law, then what's he teaching them about mishpat? That's the letter of the law. That's justice to the letter of the law. So how can you have both? And what the Rambam is expressing is that that's what the mida beinonis is. To be able to have two different emotions that sometimes are opposites. To have the capability to have those emotions. And understand when it's time for tzedakah and when is it time for mishpat. To understand when is it time to have a little more kas and when is it time to have a lot less kas. And that's what the Mida Beinonis is, to understand how to balance our emotions, balance our character traits. And that is exactly what we're saying. Haman was not able to do that. Haman didn't understand that if I am really, really happy, I can also get a little angry at something. It was either really, really happy or really, really sad. It was the extremes. But what he didn't understand is, if you have both capabilities, you have to understand when to be happy, when to sad, when to be a little more sad. It doesn't mean when I see Mordechai, nothing matters anymore. It means when I see Mordechai, so I'm a little more upset. When I don't see him, I'm more happy. That's the Mida Beinonis. That's the way we're supposed to act. And Haman didn't recognize that. Mordechai did. Mordechai was Lo kam, Mordechai was yoshev. He was upset at one point, but then he was sitting, he was calm. What did he need to get all angry at Haman for? He understood how to balance his emotions. The truth is, Esther was the same way. And you see throughout the Megillah Esther like this, but just to give one example, you know, obviously she had to do it, but as she understood that her people were going to be destroyed, the way she tries to get at Achashverosh to tell the king is to make a mishneh, is to make a whole party. She understood that this was the time to make a party. She understood that having that party wasn't contradicting to how she was feeling. That was just what was called for at the moment. You have to understand the kol zman ve'is l'chol chayfetz is a time for everything. There's a time when you're supposed to be a little more happy, a little less happy. You just have to understand how and when to balance your character traits, to balance those emotions. And Purim underscores this. Because Purim is a day of simcha mishta. It's a yom simcha mishta. Mishta of simcha. It's a day to be happy. And at the same time, the Rama points out, avelos can still come in it. We just have to figure out how to balance the two. We have to figure out when to do one, when to do the other. When I can accentuate my sadness, when I can accentuate my joy. You know, I remember reading, they quote that Rabbi Shlomo Zalman Orbach's wife passed away on Shabbos. So they quote that they told him on Shabbos, and for halachic reasons, he didn't cry or anything on Shabbos, because it was Shabbos. But the better part of the story is they write that after Shabbos, he went to go deal with his wife's body in the hospital, and as he was walking down the stairs, one of his students walked into him, and his student said, saw his Rebbe and said, Mazel Tov, I just had a baby. And Rabbi Shlomo Zalman looked at him and said, wow, Mazel Tov, that's amazing, gave him a few brachos. 2 days later, the student comes to pay a shiva call. He didn't realize, and he begs, he's apologizing, he's crying to Rabbi Shlomo Zalman Orbach. I'm so sorry. I didn't realize what was happening. Rabbi Shlomo Zalman looks confused. What are you talking about? What does my sadness have to do with you? I was sad. There was a simcha. I said, Mazel Tov. I understand when and how I should be sad and how I should be happy. I'm able to balance my emotions. That's the most ideal way of going about it. Now, I remember I got married a week before Rosh Hashanah, at the end of Elul. And I remember speaking to my parents. I was a little hesitant about getting married, and I just felt I was a little uncomfortable. I thought it was a strange time to get married at the end of Elul. And I remember speaking to one of my rabbeim, and he said a few things, but one of the things he mentioned is that it's not, ideally, that's not supposed to be a contradiction. The fact that you're going to be happy at a wedding, and you're very serious because it's Elul, that doesn't have to contradict. You can still be happy at your wedding, and then you can still have a very serious time of tshuva. And it's very hard, especially in our day and age, to be able to have two of those types of emotions to coexist, because we always try to jump on the first thing we have. But the way we're supposed to act, that balanced mentality, is to understand that we can have mixed emotions. We can have, theoretically, some form of mourning in a time of joy, and we just have to figure out how. We have to be able to balance the two. And I think, you know, if people are asked to describe Zaidi, so often people describe his passion and his the fiery attitude that he had. But as a grandchild, and I assume the other grandchildren can attest it, I didn't really, you know that part. I knew the hugs I used to get and the funny noises he would make to me, the softness. And Uncle Avi read those two letters he read at the beginning speak to that same point. The intensity on one hand, but the understanding of how to be calm and how to be, you know, compassionate and sensitive and be not compassionate and sensitive at the same time. And to be able to balance those emotions, I think very much speaks to Zaidi, at least in my relationship with him. And I thought, again, starting with the fact that, in very short, this was written in one of the notebooks, and his yard side, again, is right before, Mishanechnas Adar Marbim Besimcha. Now, this idea is really emphasized and accentuated. The idea of how to handle, how to balance mixed emotions, how to be able to handle, you know, two opposite emotions with the Midah Beinonis, understanding what to do. You know, Purim really brings that out. The story of Purim really brings that out. The halachos of Purim really bring it out. And hopefully, you know, we can be inspired by, obviously, both of Zaidi's life, inspired by the Megillah and everything we'll read over Purim. And hopefully the Divrei Torah should be an aliyah for his neshama, for Zaidi's neshama, and should bring a lot of nachas to Zaidi. Thank you, everyone.